very, very interesting. Because how do we really change, you know? And just to illustrate why I think it's brave, a couple of years ago, I was at a meeting in the United States, and elderly librarian started to tell us about how young students are today. I mean, I don't feel particularly aged myself, but I must admit I didn't really understand anything of what he was talking about, you know? And then he said, listen, outside now I have five youngsters, five kids from this university who I have never seen before. And he called them in, you know, and it fitted all. I mean, they knew all about Facebook and social networking and all these type of things, which I had heard nothing about myself, I think. Maybe it was 3 years ago already. So I asked myself, what is Facebook today? I mean, what is the thing I haven't even heard of today, you know, which everyone is using, you know, the youngsters, because it's really the young generation which is driving the change, I think, in this business. And I think that David also got a bit surprised when he saw this battery of young people here, you know. So maybe they can also challenge you a bit on what you are going to present. I'm at least very much looking forward to it. Another very interesting observation I just picked up over lunch is that also that all these new trends and passions also brings up a new interest for our profession. And David told me, you know, at his university, there are double as many archivist students now as the year before, which I think is a very, very interesting observation. So the floor is yours, and we are looking forward to hear about digital consumers.
Thank you very much. It's a rather unusual setup because I usually like walking around and talking, because the topic is so dynamic that I'm almost forced to sit down. So if I sort of look as though I'm ill, don't worry, I'm just trying to get a position, which is right. I'm going to take my jacket off, I think, because all you young people there, you know, that's bad news. What's quite interesting is that, you know, this is the home of the internet and Tim Berners-Lee and all of that, and if you watch the BBC, there's a very interesting program called Virtual Revolution, which is being televised on Saturday nights at the moment, which Tim is, and I'm also in it from opposite sort of perspectives. But while we understand, in a sense, the technical implications of the web and all the rest of it, and I don't suppose you could have imagined ever to have such an amazing discovery, amazing event that's powered everything. But in fact, it pales by comparison to what is actually unleashed, because these things are for people, and people never behave in the way that you expect them, and certainly not the way machines or systems people expect them. And they're often disappointed about people's behaviour because we're not very nice people, really. You know, we behave in unusual and different ways. And so I suppose what I'm going to tell you is really what, in a sense, that internet revolution has actually unleashed in terms of human behaviour, in terms particularly of human information-seeking behaviour, because, as you're aware, search is everything. You could even talk about search engines at parties nowadays, whereas 20 years ago you would have been taken out by men in white suits. But nowadays, Google, retrieval engine, meta, everything is all part and parcel of the party scene. Now, lots and lots of people make all kinds of statements about how we behave on the web, and most of it is what I call PowerPoint puff. You know, everybody's got an anecdote, everybody's got an angle, and everybody says it's like this. And then when you ask them, as you should in a place like this, where is the data for this, you'll find that they have no data at all, other than personal experience. Well, one thing we have is we have data coming out of our eyes. We have so much data, it almost, well, would figure here in CERN as a reasonable database. We've been mapping, evaluating people's behavior in the virtual space for 7 years. In all kinds of strategic areas like health, publishing, academe, charity work, and we actually started in newspapers. And all kinds of statements are made when people move into the space from a physical world, and it doesn't always go like you would think. So what I'm going to do is really distill 7 years worth of data, but I'll not show you a graph or a number, because in fact it's the implications of the data that's the really important thing. Because the one problem about the internet is that data numbers mean nothing anymore, because everybody's doing 20 million or 50 million. It's gone, it's all lost. It's really the implications of what these numbers mean. What I'm going to do in a sort of popular way, just to get the conversation going, is really to sort of portray it almost cartoon-like, but not quite. But if you want to go to our site, you'll see the publications, you'll see the data, and we publish in all the top journals and all the rest of it. But it's lost in that. It's just of use to researchers. So what we've done, and what our work certainly is connected to, is the policy makers, the education makers, the politicians and so on, who are conscious of some changes, some huge changes, some meta changes going on in our universe, which are not fully understood. And the driver, and this is why, I feel like I'm one of the Rolling Stones. I've been traveling around Europe giving the same kind of message, getting different kind of responses, I must say, in different parts, is really sort of laying it out and saying, well, this is what we got. It's challenging, it's disturbing, it's worrying. What are we doing about it? Not much. We're watching it. We're voyeurs caught in what is going on, and I think we have to stand back. We've been down this digital revolution path quite a long time, and we must not mistake the fact that already there have been huge meta changes, which we must understand, because I think we're constantly looking for new change and postponing an understanding of the changes that have got already. And I mean, my banner is the future is now, and we don't understand the future. And we're constantly chasing a future that has already arrived. And that sounds grandiose and all the rest of it, but in fact I'll start showing you things and asking you for your responses. And I'm quite happy for you to, I lecture in a big information school, and I'm quite happy for people breaking in, waving their arms around, so don't feel you can't if the message gets to you. So that's what I'm going to be talking about. Basically going to take you through it. So I think I'm going to sit down now for a few minutes, and then I'll get up if I need be. Right. These words are really important, and most of them begin with D for some reason, but I'm trying to think of why digital, but there's lots of other words that begin with D. That if anybody ever went to the online conferences, or still goes to the online conference in Olympia in December, when everybody goes and chats with their colleagues and does a lot of Christmas shopping, these were words that were very much bandied around in the 1990s, disintermediation. Awful word, isn't it? I mean, some people can't even say it. But in fact, the significance, all these words are coming to haunt us now, as often is the case, but we forget them. So I'm going to come back to some of these words and some of these terms. And the other one I always like, how many times have you ever been to a conference in which somebody's mentioned the word choice? Lovely, simple English word, choice. And we all have choice. Massive, massive choice. In a way that we never had choice before. In fact, we were told what we should choose. And now, disintermediated, we all choose what we want. Yeah? And that's what's happened. But how come we don't talk about choice? I think it's because it's a common word. It's a consumer word. When I first introduced the word consumer, to talk about basically users, somebody said, I don't regard my constituency to be consumers. They're customers. Consumer is a bad word. How dare you use it in the information environment? So I continue to use it millions and millions of times, because what I'm talking about is choice. You can't be a consumer unless you have choice. If you have massive choice, you can be a very happy consumer. And this is what we're going to be seeing. Think about disintermediation. At one time, basically speaking, you had to access information through the offices of someone else. That someone else controlled that information environment, made sure allegedly only quality, relevant material was there to meet your user needs. It was a closed environment. It was a controlled environment. It was a peer review environment. And in that environment, certain tools were just standard. Yeah? Who's Who for biographical information, Whitaker's Almanac for, you know, stats, and so on and so on. And you had a need, and that need was biographical, you went there. If you wanted statistical information, you went there. It was there. It was a clean, controlled, top-down world. Bang! Completely blown up and disappeared. We are all librarians now. We're all journalists now. We're all publishers now. That's really very important. And when you look at this behavior that you'll be seeing, you'll understand that in fact what you are seeing is people pretending, behaving like librarians. Except, in most cases, they operate like e-shoppers, which is pretty interesting. So, disintermediation, another very, very important word, and one that explains what is actually going on in this virtual world. The other one is in a sense this sort of move into the virtual space, this complete and utter migration of many activities into the virtual space. At UCL now, you will never see a member of staff, a professor in the library anymore. Gone. Completely gone. And it won't be long before you don't see the students anymore, because e-books, e-textbooks are becoming de rigueur. Students are moaning and complaining that there's this fantastic world out there, but then you go to university, and the university people say, yeah, you've got to read these three books, but we've only got three copies. And then there are queues, there are all kinds of complicated loan systems, and we actually make information a hard-to-get commodity. Our students pay £6,000 a year, them and their parents aren't happy about it. Okay, so that's going to blow. So we've only just beginning to see the move into the virtual space. Scientists were the first time. And there are still thousands and millions of people who are still about to move into the virtual space and enjoy the so-called benefits of that kind of space. So when I talk to my humanities colleagues, our art colleagues, they look at me in disbelief when I talk about the benefits of the digital universe. It does not, has not yet, is changing. So more and more people are going into that virtual space, yes? Most information activities are conducted in the virtual space. Great, okay. Now, do you think that as a result of moving into that virtual space, your behavior changes? Or do you think you take all of what you had before and you do exactly what you did before in the virtual space? However, many policymakers, many leaders still carry the paradigm of behavior, hard copy behavior, into the virtual world. Now, one of the greatest problems, of course, is as people migrate into the virtual world, you know less and less and less about them. Not only have they been disintermediated, you don't see them, but you know virtually nothing at all about them. No, you don't. I search all kinds of systems here when I'm on travelling, and I don't go anywhere near the library, don't even know where I am or what I'm doing, or have the time to evaluate what I'm doing. So the big danger for the information profession is possibly publishing later on, certainly journalism, but certainly librarians, is they're being decoupled from their user base. Providing services, people don't even know they're providing those services, and they know nothing about the behavioural patterns of all of their users, and more, because there was only a subset that ever used the library. Now everybody uses the virtual space. So you can see the possible tension. In fact, it's more than a possible tension. You can see it already. And I think uncoupling, decoupling, coaches coming off the train is something very sort of physical to think about in this kind of anonymous virtual world. So more and more people going to this space, more and more people doing things you don't know about. What happens to the intermediary? Yeah. Ooh. I think in most businesses you would be really worried. So what I'm going to do is really try and visualize what has actually happened into this virtual space, show you these kind of characteristics, and maybe tease out from yourself, certainly for myself, what we have to do as information professionals in the broader sense if we want some stake, if we want not to miss out in the information society. Can you imagine telling your grandchildren, well, me, that what did you do, Dad, in the digital revolution? I lost my job. I don't want to think that. You know, it's like the oil industry. It's the same thing. It's that this is where we step up to the plate. But not many people are. And that's the problem. Okay. Okay, this is just a little summary of, the data collection that we've been doing. And we've developed a system called Deep Log Analysis. We call it Deep Log Analysis because it gives us a kind of brand and distinguishes us from all the data miners there are in the world, busy data mining. We actually try and create shapes from our data, and we try and understand information seeking, usage and consumer behavior through it. And what we do, I mean, as you know, every digital system you go into, whether that's a mobile phone, whether that's television today, whether that's a touchscreen kiosk, or whether it's the internet, you leave a trace behind you. It's called a log. Most people bung their logs away. In fact, we got most of our business because people can't even store the logs. And they're saying to us, what can we do with these logs? Can you do anything with them worthwhile? Here they have an unbelievable 24/7, 364 days a year, detailed analysis of information-seeking behavior that they've never had ever before, and guess what they're doing with it? Throwing it away or giving it to us, yeah? My, I don't believe it. I can't believe it. It's still going on. Here we have, in a world in which information-seeking is everything, even e-shopping, and all the records, all the chronicles, all the paradigms, all the models of information behavior are now there. No sampling, every single person that goes into the system. We have the digital fingerprints of maybe 20 to 30 million people. Now, can you imagine? You know, 20 years ago, a large sample was 10,000, 5,000, and that was skewed and it was awful. And now you don't talk about samples. And the great thing about logs, and there are downsides about logs, is they are evidence of what people did, not what they say that they did, or not what they said they might do, or whatever else. because people have a nasty habit of exaggerating, lying, and not telling the truth. Or they cannot even remember. And I'll put it to you, you don't ever remember what you do in cyberspace. You leave your memory behind you and then pick it up at Google or wherever. So it's a very firm evidence base of what people actually did, not what they would like to do. And you have to be careful with information and libraries, because it's a public good. People think, yeah, you're nice, you're doing a good job, do you use me? Yes. And then of course we look at the library records and we notice that one quarter of the people have said they did, never did, but they just wanted to be pleasing, because we're social animals. But these logs don't lie. They don't lie. And they just pour in, as I'm speaking, day in, day out. People from all around the world, all languages, all creeds, all ages, and whatever else. And of course, when you have such big data sets, you can cut them up in any particular way you like. So, we have an evidence base. And what we do, and that's the most important thing of all, because the problem with quantitative data is that it doesn't often give you the cause of the data you need. For us, the most important thing about DeepLog is it raises the questions that we should ask in questionnaires and focus groups, because we are still asking the same old, busted, tired questions. How frequently did you use the web last week? What do you mean, frequently? What do you mean, web? Well, you know, I mean, you just get gobbledygook, you know? We're still stuck. But there are really interesting questions coming out of those logs. Huge things that are raising big cultural, social, and educational things. Yeah? Not just within our own orbit. Within the whole of society. But we didn't know whether we had to ask this. We didn't know. And as you'll see, we'll go through some of the data, and you'll see questions just rise out of it. And they're questions that we have not been asking, and that we need to, if we're to ride the revolution. Because, as you'll see, there's a danger that we're actually blowing it. Okay. No doubt you'll put this up on your website or something like that, so this is just a kind of detail thing of the footprint of all the data that we can gather about people's activities in cyberspace in regarding to consuming information, looking at information, viewing information, and all the rest of it. And then the ability to relate those data sets to user data sets to get age, gender, nationality, even attitude. You know, you can begin to link questionnaires with the digital fingerprints, so that the digital fingerprints, instead of just providing a hit count, actually tell you a user who's using your services. And it begins to tell you about diversity. Because, you know, to know that 7 million people do this is, I mean, that's a Nobel Prize winner, that's an undergraduate, is meaningless. You know, we need to actually drill down. So that's really, you know, the detail. There are 30 characteristics there, and most people would be familiar from the logs of simply one characteristic, how many downloads. So we're all happy with downloads. Well, as you'll see, downloads are a very dodgy currency. Yeah, and we should not hide behind downloads. It is not the really interesting statistic. It is a marketing. Oops. Okay. Now, what have we learnt about information seeking from all of these digital fingerprints when we begin to analyse them, begin to cut them up, and all the rest of it? What are the big meta messages? What are the big stories? Well, the really big story, and it is a fantastic story, really, although it has a problem in it. Is that information, particularly scholarly information, particularly research information, is hugely popular. It's just absolutely massive. You cannot even believe, because we all thought scholarly or research information had a narrow constituency. We first began to realize that when the sort of National Library of Medicine and so on in the States noticed that people coming into their clinical websites, the majority were consumers who had a need, the informed patient. So that's the great news, is that there is a huge potential, or apparently there is a huge potential demand, which should give every information professional, every publisher, educationist, a lovely warm glow that says, wow, look, this isn't food, it's the food of today, I suppose, this is really popular. Guess what? Even scholarly downloads, as Science Direct, Oxford Journals, whatever, are increasing at 20% a year, 10 or 12 years down the line. Now, any business, you were telling me that you're having 20,000 more potential purchases or customers, you would be happy. It hasn't lived. It is going up and up and up. And I have a theory about this, which I'll come back to. But it is going up phenomenally. And the numbers look absolutely amazing. Well, it's not difficult to see why, really. Because, one, people who already had access, like myself, UCL has a fantastic collection, can now use the data anywhere I go in the world. In fact, I do most of mine, I have a farm, on my farm kitchen table. That is my laboratory. That's where I do it at stations, I do it at McDonald's, I do it at coffee bars, I do it all of the time. So, whereas my usage was constrained by the opening hours or the physical location of the library, I have no limitations. So that just fuels growth phenomenally. And every time they increase broadband, and every country is increasing broadband, it makes it easier to be connected to the big fat pipe. We are all connected now to the big fat pipe. And that's the second reason for growth. There's a whole bunch of people that never had access to university libraries. People that never live anywhere near a library. And libraries never let people in. They don't like it. They're an exclusive bunch and all the rest of it. Now, thanks to open access and all of those other kinds of things, is that anybody can be a scholar. And there's millions of people in the world that are interested scholarly in either gardening or painting or Italy or whatever else. And these people are coming flooding in to the market. So those two factors are driving growth phenomenally. I feel great to be part of that world. But there's something that nags. And that's what we're going to come back to. So the story is a good story. And we've got to do something about that story. But there's an undertow, as you'll see. Here are some numbers, but they're just meaningless numbers, but they just give power to this sense. There is a massive potential demand. People don't seem to be able to get enough. And factors like education, lifelong learning, all of these things are going to add to that. Broadband, digitisation. I mean, lots of stuff is only just coming on. We're working on the Europeana project. You can see, as these resources have been digitised, people were just beginning to pour in. All of these factors are only in place, just only beginning to happen. And they're going to take use and growth to new heights, which is a great. So, we should all have a warm feeling. We should be congratulating everybody, because in a sense, maybe information professionals' greatest thing is the provision of access. We have provided the access that is generating the demand. But the problem is, access is not an outcome. And we've all grown used to access. And we need to do not access bean counting, we need to do outcome bean counting. Because if we don't, that is where we go down. Okay? Well, what we've seen is vast amounts of activity. I like to use the word activity, because we always make the assumption that a visit, a download, is a positive outcome. And this is where I'm beginning to do that. But as you are quite aware, much of it is noise. And that's what we need to look at. Here's an interesting thing, is that wherever we've gone, we take the raw logs, right? We don't take any proprietary logs. We just take the raw logs and process them and run them through SPSS ourselves. That way, we squeeze everything out of the logs. Otherwise, people are filtering out great stuff, which knits together to get a great picture of information seeking. They don't see that, and we see that, so we're stitching it together so we don't throw nothing away. And whatever commission we've done, whatever project, whether it's been for newspapers, we've done the Times, whether it's been for the British Health Service, we've done the Times, the biggest user group are robots. If anybody tells me things haven't changed, then this surely is it. 30 years ago, when I was in professional practice, there were no robots. You never had to consider a user as a robot. I mean, they'd take you away. They'd say you're an absolute. In fact, you could not even envisage 30 years ago that robots would be users. It's like a science fiction movie, okay? So wherever we go, wherever we see, robots are the biggest. Okay. Now, lots of systems filter robots out because they think, oh, you know, don't like robots, they're like immigrants, we'll keep them out of the country, we won't count them, they don't count at all, therefore, you know, just get rid of them. So they have various means by which they screen out robots, but of course robots are extremely intelligent, especially Google ones. These are the spiders that index, sorry if I use the word robot and you're not familiar with it, is the spiders and the bots that go around indexing the web and so on. And that even if you try and keep them out, they have wonderful ways of getting in. And one of the greatest ways of identifying a robot is because robots have unbelievable appetites, like they suck up. When we were doing the Times, London Times, and we noticed, and the biggest user was something from out of Tokyo, and it appeared to be swallowing the whole site every day and taking it to Tokyo, which is strictly illegal, of course, you know, so then we, you know, this was big news. And it was some encyclopedia site that was just sucking it up and just taking it away. So, you know, anyway, so, you know, system designers got quite familiar with that. I thought, right, okay, we'll screen out whenever we see big behavior, they, you know, we'll screen them out. Of course, then robots adapted, and they adapted, and they made their behavior like humans, because they could come in. Anyway, so there's always been the case, 50-60% of use, some of it screened out, some of it not, but sizable. Then we did a study on the House of Commons, the library, which is more than a library, it's a research unit, everything, very powerful in the UK. Someone says, something comes from the House of Commons library, they say, it must be true. Okay, so it has. And they said, we want to know the extent to which MPs are using the resource, because we spend a lot of money on it. Is it the MPs, or is it the library staff, or is it the research assistants? You know, how's it balancing out? Because you need different systems for different people. Went in there. The robots were the biggest users. Okay. In the last year we did it, 90% of all usage of the system was robots. Previous year it was 70%. We think the following year it could hit 99. Robots have completely gone wild in that system. I suggest robots are indexing robots or something. But something. And what's really interesting, there are pages that only robots go to. Humans never go to. Only robots go to. Information system gone wild? They don't know. And the systems are carrying on. Kind of anarchy. It's a lack of understanding of what has actually changed in our virtual spaces, our information spaces. What about the humans? Let's talk about the humans for a while, because these are the most interesting ones. Now, I'm going to use words that you probably never encountered with information-seeking behavior before. Bouncing, promiscuity, and similar. But these are our new words. The words that help us understand information-seeking behavior and usage in the virtual space. Over half of all visitors view 1 to 3 pages from the thousands available. Bounce in and bounce out again. This breaks the heart of system designers and systems advocates who thinks the way to get to a user's heart is to have more and more and more pages. And they cry and get very miserable when they find out that in fact many of their pages are never used or are only used by robots. Why do people bounce? Because of search engines? Yeah, it's just the nature of search engines. You know, they give you the choice, you are now disintermediated, you see 5 things, and you haven't got a clue which is the best. You look, you're trying to make up your mind, you're trying to work it out. Brand, what's brand in cyberspace? Oh, it's really difficult. Well, let's suck it and see. And that suck it and see generates a kind of bouncing behavior. You go in, I'm not sure about that, you go out, and you bounce. So bouncing is a means of coping with information overload, with coping with being a librarian, if you like. I'm unsure. I don't know. I've got to suck it and see. Massive choice. You can't be a bouncer if there's only one thing. The more things you have, the more you can bounce. You just think about it. You go to your local village shop. You know exactly what's in the village shop. And you go knowing that. And you get your bread and you come out again. You go to a supermarket. You go to Tesco's or you go to Carrefour's. And the bigger the supermarket, the more you get sirened in. You look around, your behavior changes. Of course it does. And that's what we're confronted with. We're confronted with a giant supermarket that is constantly refreshing its goods. And the way you come to it is constantly refreshed by the search engine, which you all use. But there is also, I mean, you don't hear the word information overload anymore. And when I was a student, when I was a young lecturer, especially in science, we were constantly told about the information explosion, the tidal wave that would bury us all. Look what we've got. We've got the internet. That is absolutely a tsunami in terms of it. But who's complaining about overload? Nobody. And yet, we have genuine overload. Because people have developed a form of behavior that copes with it. They want the access, they want the choice, but they don't want the overload. So what do? They bounce. and they have this unbelievable pragmatic attitude of acceptance of failure. We can't look at it all, so we're only going to look at a bit of it. PhD students, I'm not just talking about, you know, we've done lots of work with PhD students, physicists, all the rest, they have exactly the same sort of thing. Yeah. Pragmatic, in and out. If I can't find it soon, I don't care. Convenience beats content. Nobody ever goes beyond the second Google results page. Not because they think that's where the two pages of total relevance lie. They don't even check. It's just because it's the easiest thing to do. And let's trust Google. We know that. We know that the average person puts in 2.2 words to search the world's resources. Looks at two or three pages. And usually does it via a search engine. And expects to find the answer. Pragmatic. That's what they become. But bouncing can be a sign of failure. And it is worrying that it is in the case of young people. But it can also be a sign of absolute precision bombing. My people know exactly what they want, and know exactly the problems of searching the web, and go in and out. It's like, you know, the fast bag pickup compared to the fast bag drop. In and out. Give me that media and get me out of here. They don't want to look around. They don't spend any time looking around. In and out. The younger people are, the more they bounce. And this promiscuity. Not many people come back. So they penetrate very deeply. A large amount of people don't go back. They don't go back because they have short-term memories. They can't remember. Nobody stores any keywords anymore. People hardly bookmark apart from holidays and things like that. Poor retrieval skills, Google searching, and the churn rate of what you get all adds to the fact that people don't come back very often. They call it stickiness. Site stickiness is a so-called attribute. But the whole system is conspiring to prevent that. The younger they are, the more promiscuous they are. So already building a pattern for young people. They bounce more, they're more promiscuous. What we're building to is the horizontal has replaced the vertical in terms of information seeking. We don't go deep anymore. We go across. We now drive that way rather than drive that way. Let me give you an example. I was looking at these logs and I was seeing this behavior, which was in and out, don't come back very often. And I was thinking, this seems to be against. It must be wrong because system designers don't think like that. They think, let's capture them, give them a home, give them lots of features, get them in our website and hold on to them. And I'm thinking, system designers must be right. The data must be wrong. Okay. So I was trying to crack this and I was getting irritated because I thought it was a methodology. I thought we'd really got the methodology wrong. And I was at home thinking about this, pouring through the logs, and my daughter, Victoria, teenager, was lying in the other room on the sofa, as teenagers do, lying on the sofa with the remote, watching television. Okay? I don't watch TV like that, so that probably made me more irritated. And she was flicking from channel to channel to channel to channel. And I was getting increasingly angry because A, I couldn't understand my problem, and B, she was behaving in a way that I didn't think was very good. So I said to her, I said, Victoria, can't you make up your mind what you're watching? With venom. And she said, without venom, Dad, I'm watching it all. And she was watching it all. When something got a little bit boring, when the plot was going slow, she went somewhere else to see whether in fact the plot somewhere else was a bit more fast. And then she might or she might not return, whatever else like that. Now, is that a dumbed down form of behavior? Is my form of behavior infinitely superior? Which is, read the Radio Times on the net, see what program's on, see what day Arsenal's playing Chelsea, get in a couple of beers, make sure it's all ready, sit there for an hour and a half, and then go to bed. Completely different. And my daughter never behaves like that, ever. Yeah? In fact, that's just the TV. Normally, she's multitasking. She's doing about three things at the same time. Because of the stimulus of having to get something, you know, that without that stimulus. And that stimulus is leading to a kind of form of behavior that's almost frenetic. Yeah. You're driven that way. In a sense, you get a buzz out of that kind of way. It's all a long service. Moving through titles, contents, pages, and abstracts at a huge rate. Listen to this academic. This is an academic at UCL. I can update my knowledge very quickly. She's talking about an e-book database which we were trialing. I can update my knowledge very quickly. The sheer number of books is overwhelming. If I can look at them very quickly, you know, within 15 minutes, I can look at three or four books and get some very superficial knowledge of what is in them. Nevertheless, it improves my scholarship because in the back of my mind, these books already exist. Digital osmosis. It's like people who buy books, put them in your library, and somehow feel empowered by those books and never read them. And it's also, in a sense, when people download the PDFs, that's again what they do, that hope one day, as they sit at the terminal, as they rub the mouse, the contents will somehow come up into it. So, interesting. People power browse. It's a good way of doing it. They drive through, hoovering up bits and pieces of information as they go. Now the interesting thing is, abstracts have never been more popular. I remember when I started, when there were only abstracts, if you did any library survey and say, what would you want? And they say, anything, but not another abstract. Because they're teased. Now people use abstracts to do the power browsing. They create great motorways by which you can move fast over the territory. Many people don't actually go beyond the abstract. And the publisher's response is to put more stuff in the abstract because they know that. And Elsevier and all of these others are beginning to power abstracts with real data, because they know that is the fast food that people will consume in vast quantities. And we know the longer an article, the less likely it is to be read. The longer an article, the more likely the abstract is to be read. And I was at a conference of editors, Taylor Francis editors from great journals around the world, 100 of them, I was giving this kind of talk. And a woman editor said, You know, we ask for 7,000 words or 8,000 words. You're telling me that's too much. Think about it.
We've all been conditioned by PowerPoints, texting, tweeting, emailing, all of those things.
We can't do anything, one thing, for very long. We have to do lots of things. I'll give you an example. I went to an e-inclusion conference in Brussels. They paid my fare, brought me over on Eurostar. I said, how many minutes have you got to give? I said, it's quite some big messages here. 15 minutes. 15 minutes? I can't do a 15 minute thing. I can only give you platitudes. Okay, 18 minutes. Okay, I get there. 18 minutes. But, you know, give my number, power it at the front, put the date at the front. I looked at the audience, and about 22 of the audience were tweeting, and the rest of them were sending their emails. They could not even give me 18 minutes. Now, I'm not knocking that. Maybe I'd do that as well. But that's the thing, is the attention span, that sort of concentration level of dealing with one thing, has been overcome by the ability to do lots of things. And this is, I'm shunting you to where this is taking us, because we all do it, because the logs show. Okay, there are some of us who do it less, and there are some who do it more, but I'm talking about the general universe, is we see what is happening, and we see where it's taking us. And what we don't know, whether it's good, bad, indifferent, who cares, toss, I don't know, where's it leading us? What will happen to the institutions that have been built on a very different form of collecting information, of assimilating knowledge, and all of those other kinds of things? Do we not think what is going on now is challenging, I'm not being derogatory, I'm just challenging, are not challenging the edifices that we've erected already? And we can already see it in universities where you're beginning to be attacked by things that you thought were defensible, totally defensible. Students are now saying, plagiarism, there is nothing wrong with that. And universities throw students out, take away their degrees for it, and students say, but this is the way we collect information today. And yet you are hanging us for this. And I'm afraid our defences are increasingly looking uncool. We hold the line, do we? Do we hold the line about behaviour? Do we give in to the behaviour? And what happens as a result of that? These are things. We're simply chronicling this. And we're simply raising those questions that people aren't asking. And these are the questions that we have to ask, because it affects everything we do. Somebody said to me, I think it was an e-shopping guy, and it was the best thing I'd ever really, it just made me think more than anything else, because I have to change my paradigm. I was brought up in a completely different world. Yeah. And he said, Dave, he said, an internet year is 7 weeks. At first I thought he was saying something absolutely mad, and then I realised what he said. Is the internet moves, I don't know, Facebook wasn't here 3 years ago. The internet moves at a completely different pace. You cannot use standard 12-month things when people used to go around on a boat, used to walk across Europe and take the same metric to. So, 1 year plan, 3 year plans, look, these guys, you should be doing three in 3 months. And so maybe that sets the tone, is that maybe this 15 minutes is a long time. Maybe the 2 minutes people spend on a typical site, given the 7 weeks, given we have just been fast forward to a much more rapid universe. And we need to take this in context. So when I say the average person, visit the site for, well, it's easy to find, 7, 8, 9 minutes, and they spend, you know, 5 seconds on a page and things like that. We need to actually look at that in the light of that. In the UK, a judge recently, this is nothing to do with my project, but it's redolent of what's happening and, you know, the data and the practices are beginning to think about it. We have a jury system in the UK, and juries are often given very difficult things to deal with and expected to act on the evidence, and they're laymen, laywomen, you know, they're not judges, whatever else, and they have to go through the evidence and all the rest of it. This judge was saying it's increasingly difficult for that type of justice to continue because people aren't good at listening anymore. That what we're going to do is trial giving them the data through a laptop. Because it is more acceptable, it is easier. Now that's, you know, the story, the oral has always been regarded as a big thing. So wheels are falling off, and we need a big picture to fit this in. Oops. Yes, this is for, none of you look like, I'm not going to say it because I could upset someone, but you all look young and vibrant and interesting and all the rest of it, so this will be no surprise to you at all. Is, certainly librarians and even some publishers have always made better assumptions about behaviour on the part of scholars, researchers, physicists and so on than really they should. And a couple of very interesting things here is that, basically speaking, people just don't like advanced systems at all. They just want to cut to the chase. They want to come in very cleanly, very simply, and hence Google is huge. Now I know physics has a wonderful information system and it's had it for years. It's been the kind of example of information systems. And, you know, very well looked after, free and easy to get, and well, everything, by every hallmark in physics, perhaps has the, if you had an ideal information system. We were doing a study of researchers in the UK and all the big universities, how they accessed e-journals, whether there were differences between the top university departments and the not so top between physics and chemistry and all the rest of it. And of course, we had access to all the logs of ScienceDirect, which is, you know, the sort of, you know. And when we started in January, Google and its robots had no access at all to ScienceDirect. So if you wanted to get hold of a physics journal in ScienceDirect, you would simply have to go to the ScienceDirect site or something like that, and then put in your password and then go through it that way. So in January, there was no Google traffic coming into the physics journals on ScienceDirect. In April, they opened out physics journals and all the other journals, mostly in ScienceDirect, to Google. 40% of the traffic coming into physics journals was via Google. 40%. Interesting, isn't it, really? Because here's a domain that is self-sufficient, has its own things, has very high quality marks, and yet, within a month, behaviour had changed. And we didn't look just at physics, we didn't look at just science subjects, we looked at humanities subjects. And in fact, the biggest users of Google all around are historians. The advanced searching is a lovely one. Every system you have as advanced searching on it, yes? You know, little box, you know, everything. Right? I'm not going to embarrass anybody by asking, anyway, you probably all, I know you're good, so you'd all be advanced searching systems. Anyway, of course we could tell if they elected to do that on the simple search, and we could tell whether it's Oxford, Cambridge, UCL, physics, chemistry, whatever else. Universally, nobody uses advanced search. Okay? Nobody does. So, why have we got the advanced search? Is it some belief that, some higher belief in scientists that they do need that? Well, we went to the publishers and said, guys, you know, nobody's using this, is there? They say, it's because the librarian says you must provide it. Yes, I mean, as you know, it's that, you know, half, most of the fun is actually travelling and not getting there, especially as you don't really want to read, because we know you don't read, or you don't like reading, or you've postponed reading, you want to consume at great fast speed, and so when you look at the logs, you'll see that, you know, most of the time people are actually just wandering around, viewing, travelling, enjoying themselves, and all of those other kinds of things. And I just want to, I don't know how good you're on e-books here, but we've been part of a number of big studies in which we've dropped textbooks into 127 British libraries, university libraries, and looked and watched the logs of their take-up. But if you look at something like Oxford Scholarship Online, you look what people are doing to books. Books were closed. They were in concrete. You could not drive through them. Now, when you look at something like Oxford Scholarship, go on, look at it. I don't get any money out of it. Oxford Scholarship Online. It is like the most beautiful roads are being driven through philosophy, history, all of the humanities subjects, connecting authors, connecting words, connecting papers in a way that they've never been connected before. There are huge opportunities for knowledge discovery here. Just massive, courtesy of the roads that have been opened up in books. Books are now coming with abstracts. Books are now coming with keywords. And books, of course, to students and humanities people, are the key resource. But not only that, I believe that many of us use e-journals, when in fact we should be using e-books, but there's no e-books in our terrain. Because often we're not looking for state-of-the-art research, we're looking for consolidated knowledge and facts. Yeah. And we often use journals because they're accessible to get that, when in fact. So, I mean, you know, if just talk about navigation, it's just unbelievable. And already we're beginning to see people driving through and creating all kinds of new roads in an unbelievably rich literature. And you think of the digitization that's going on at the moment, you are thinking what we sit on in terms of book knowledge that has largely been consigned to cul-de-sacs. If you drive down that way, you read it, but not anymore. It's on the superhighway, in the same shop as e-journals. And the synthesis and the symbiosis of those two are going to create all things. But who's telling users about this? Who's telling people about the mashup opportunities here? People don't know. Because there is so much to know. And I think we have to have a much more strident voice in this. In fact, I mean, how long have I got? Okay, so how long? Another 5, 10? Okay. Something I'll put to you, because I was giving this talk to a group of doctors. Now, doctors to me, medical doctors, they always seem to be the people that had what I'd call the command-driven information system. Medline, Medlars, National Library for Health, all of those things, you know, absolutely control systems, you know, with all of the information screened, evidence stuff, and all the rest of it. I thought, this is a powerhouse. And you know, when I was a, a, a library student, I learnt a lot about these things, and you know, that was it. So I hadn't ever given a talk to medical doctors since then. And UCL has a big biomedical school, it's massive, and it uses lots of doctors in the community to take the students to give them practice. So as a thank you, they were giving conferences, and I came and gave my Google Generation one, saying, well, you know, what's going on? And I was telling them about the Google Generation, and they were all nodding and saying, yeah, my kids behave like that. What can I do about it? You know, all the rest of it. And they were saying, oh, please help me, you know. And I'm thinking, it was interesting. But I thought, then turn the torch on them. And I said, look, I haven't been in this business any longer. I think you guys have been less affected by what's happening out there, the fast food culture, you know, the sort of, you know, clicking and all the rest of it. I am sure you're hanging on to that solid rock of information, and you know, you go and you drink from that trough, and you know that you've had everything you need, because that trough says Medline, Medlars, National Livelihood. You know you're safe in that territory. So okay, these are practicing doctors, yeah, not research doctors. So I said, okay guys, I said, there were 200 in the room, I said, how many of you use Accepted Medica, Medline, whatever else now these days, because that was a big one in my day. Not one.
Okay.
Interesting. Okay, so I thought, there must be a new one. There must be something new that I don't know about. Tell me. And they said, and I said, okay, tell me. And then, you know, there was rustling, people looking at it, and I think, okay, right. You know, okay, where do you go for your information then, you know? And some guy said, well, he said, patients are very good, you know. They read the internet, they come with pieces of paper, and you know, and they show it to us. So, you know, I was trying to hold it, you know, kind of, I don't know my ground here. Then the next thing I said, well, yeah, anything else? Anything else? You know? And they said, well, you know, practice, experience, you know, you learn a lot by experience. Crash, boom, exploded. That glass building just went slashed over there. So something has happened to their world. By that poll of 200 doctors. And the question is, what has replaced that world? And I suspect that world has been replaced by lots of different things. Like that. Yeah. They do the power browsing, and they do that. And they don't keep going back to that single same resource. I'll forget. This is another one I must leave you with, because so we get the information in the logs, and we go to focus groups and start asking people about them, and it's like an Alcoholic Anonymous session. You know, once one person says they do it, then everybody's doing it. You know, so it's quite interesting. Anyway, this was a group of PhD students from Oxford, Cambridge, and Southampton. And do you know a database called InformaWorld? It's Taylor Francis thing. Anyway, we were doing it for Taylor Francis as a sort of thing. So we sent them in another room, and they searched InformaWorld. And then they came back, and we said, hey, you know, what do you think of it? You know, and the executives from Taylor Francis were around waiting, you know, bated breath, and they were very pleasant, you know, nice, and okay, you know, because we were the kind of facilitators, so come on, tell us more. They said, it's very quiet. Quiet? I thought they were a bit mad, really. I said, what do you mean quiet? Well, they said, when you go in there, there's no sense anyone else has ever been there. They said, it's like a monastery. It's quiet. Nobody's left you any clues. There's no wisdom of the crowd. You're suddenly in a world in which everybody's helping you. When you go to Amazon, it says, hi Dave, other people like you. Have you read books like this and all the rest of it? And all these other immersive environments. And then you arrive in this monastery, one-dimensional, flat. It does not speak to you. You cannot learn what other PhD students like you looked at. You don't know which is the most used. You are told there are 3,500 million articles in this thing, and you can choose any you like. Just sticking in a search mode. You know, it's the sound of one hand clapping. And that's what databases often are, just the sound, the system sound of one hand clapping. Now that told me, publishers are interested in blogs and wikis and things, but what they don't seem to understand is the fundamentals of their database should be totally transformed by what has actually happened. Don't park that kind of wisdom of the crowd stuff elsewhere. Build it into the system. And you think this is, you know, the new modern stuff. It isn't. I had a job when I was very young and before I went to university, and it was working in a public library. And I was a Saturday assistant. I don't know if you have them here, but on Saturdays in those days, the libraries used to be as full as Arsenal Stadium. Millions of people would pour in into libraries with books, returning books, and taking them out. And it was a huge turnover event, Saturdays. And so I was mad. And I had the job of the return book trolley person, okay? And I thought that must be the worst job anybody could have. You know, it was the best job anybody could have. As the books came in, I began to move them and put them on the shelves, and by the time I'd got 5 feet, all of them had gone. Why? Because somebody else had taken that book out. Therefore, it's worth reading. Yeah? So, yeah, it's been with us an awful long time. And we need to understand how people seek behavior and all the rest of it. Jerry finished. Oh. I think I will tell you about Tesco's. Do you have a Tesco's here? Okay, Carrefour's. Carrefour's. You have Carrefour's? Right. Okay. We took a touchscreen information kiosk. Do you know, you probably buy your metro tickets, but this would help. We put it in the pharmacy next to the pharmacy in the supermarket, big supermarket. And people came. The idea was take information to people, you know, especially people who didn't have access to the web. And yes, people use it in droves. Now, this kiosk was in, say, Tesco's. Right. It had information provided by the National Health Service, the main body in the UK. And it was a kiosk run by an outfit called Surgery Dot. Okay, three. So when people finished, we said, how did you do? Yeah, have a good time. Yeah. Okay. Whose information do you think it is? This is the big web problem. There are so many players, most of them you don't even. So this whole concept of trust and all the rest of it, authority, comes down to this. What do you think the majority said? Tesco's. Okay? It was in Tesco's. And when you said to them, aha, it's the National Health Services, most of them were very disappointed. And why were they disappointed? They were disappointed was because, one, the National Health Service is constantly criticised in the paper for being underfunded, not recognising cancer, cutting off the wrong leg, leaving patients dying in the halls and all that. But Tesco's is a really successful company. It sells banking, it sells insurance, and it sells damn good food. Yeah? You need to be very careful about brand and what people think of brand and where that brand comes from. Okay, I think I'll probably conclude on this. There's a guy from The Observer that read our Google generation, because the interesting thing about the Google generation study we did was everybody was worried about what would happen when young people became physicists, or young people, got jobs. And if they had the same behavioural patterns as they've got at the moment, which is bouncing, promiscuity, all those, if they took them to the grown-up world, what would happen to the grown-up world? You know, I mean, what kinds of things? So, anyway, this guy from The Observer, he's their technology correspondent, wrote in a way I could never write after reading that Google generation report of ours. And this is what he says.
The study confirms what many are beginning to suspect, that the web is having a profound impact on how we conceptualize, seek, evaluate and use information. What Marshall McLuhan called the Gutenberg galaxy, that universe of linear exposition, quiet contemplation, disciplined reading and study is imploding, and we don't know if what will replace it will be better or worse. But at least you can find the Wikipedia entry for Gutenberg galaxy is 0.34 seconds.
So, just a couple of points maybe to generate a bit of conversation if we haven't got any. Was it always so, and that we never knew because we could never record this? Well, to be truthful, to believe, you know, like university librarians did in the 1960s, if someone took a book out, one book out, brought one back, the whole thing was consumed. But that's the only thing they knew. One taken out, one given out. No, they look at the last page. And of course, but the trouble today is that bouncing and moving around is much, much easier to do. So in a way, we were living a lie, that none of us ever read the whole thing. So we did all spend it in the pub. But we like to think that, and the metrics always pointed to a nice thing. We've got to begin to understand what is happening, because this leads to all kinds of academic outcomes. Are people getting good degrees? Are we doing good science? But most of all, I think, are we really benefiting from the information revolution? Information 24/7, all on. Are we really taking ourselves, our cultures, our countries, up to another level? Well, when I see my students at UCL, I don't think so. They know less about information than they ever did 10 or 15 years. They don't even get taught it, because the assumption is there, it's easy, Google will get you there, and all the rest of it. So this is quite interesting, and that's what worries me most, is really that we do need to maximize this unbelievable opportunity. And it looks like we're not. We're doing okay. But I don't think we're going up to that quantum level leap. And there is a great analogy with fast food here. Yeah. We all know that maybe fast food isn't very good for us, and it causes all kinds of obesity and all the rest of it. And we've gone for fast information in equally vast volumes. And I think we've got the same kinds of problems forming in terms of digestion and all the rest of it. And I don't know if anybody is actually checking this out. And are we really fast-forwarding our e-citizens to a wonderful, bright universe in which they can do all of these wonderful actions that are being pushed into that space? Or is it just convenient? Is that where governments and everybody else just wants to part people because it's easier, it's more efficient, and who cares how they behave in that kind of environment? And what is the role of information professionals? They've sat back, they've provided the access, they've tried. Information literacy is largely failed, I think because the approach is wrong. But I think they're still sitting back. And I don't think they are moving in the way that I think they ought to be. And clearly there are opportunities here. That's it.
I'm sure that there are other worries or other reflections that would like to be shared as well, or questions maybe, so please.
Yes, I have a question. At the beginning of your speech, you were talking about the intermediation that has disappeared and also meaning, I suppose, our profession that is probably becoming more and more obsolete. on the other hand, you said that you have more students. So how do you explain those two things? Because they're somehow the people must understand that there is something in there for them in library science and information studies.
Mm.
And on the other hand, we might lose our jobs. So I don't understand very well how you link those two together.
Well, I think it's a very confusing picture. And if I tried to articulate it in a clear pathway, I don't think I could do that. All I can see is worlds colliding and not a lot going on. So yes, you know, we are getting... we're doing quite well. Lots of the other information schools in the UK are closing down, are disappearing into sort of multi-faculty things. So I think there's sort of overall... But I do think probably digital curation and that area is an area that is fruitful for our graduates. I don't know. And I wouldn't go so much on that. I mean, although I'm a director of a department that teaches students, I still worry about where they're going, what they're going to be doing, and especially in the current economic crisis when certainly university libraries in the UK have been massacred, getting rid of staff, everything. So turbulent times, you know, I don't think the dust has settled. I'm positive, don't get me wrong, I'm positive, but I'd like to be more positive and I'd like to see more action, and I'd just like to see more people looking at what's happening in this virtual space and then actually sort of translating into policy and actions and so on. I mean, in the UK at the moment. Right, so all of our activities are going to soon be determined in that virtual space. And my belief is that people aren't really, apart from, you know, people have always been good, are not going to be able to cope with that. But who cares? You know, who's stepping up to that plate? Public libraries are not doing it. School libraries are, because they've been asked to do so many things to take on the parental burden, you know, they teach manners, they teach sex, they teach everything, you know, plus history, geography and all the rest of it, and they actually do less information literacy now than they did 20 years ago. So they're the things that worry me, because I just think if it's more important, if it's more difficult, then surely, more strategic, you know, it's not just about finding books, is it? It's finding about your health. It's finding about good jobs, going to the best university. It's all of those things. They're life. And it shouldn't be done on a whim, on a bounce, uninformed. Do you know a lot of young people have got no concept of what a collection is? This word that is so important to us, the word collection. They think Google is a collection. No sense of collection. Who's teaching them that? Do you think it's important they understand what a collection is? Well, nobody's talking about it. And that's what worries me more than anything else. And, you know, this is the TV program with Tim Berners-Lee that's been going on. And I think that, you know, there's some good things there. You know, people raising some sort of real big things about what's happening to society and whose role it is to actually, it's the information Wild West we're in, isn't it? Yeah, you can see it. It's just the information Wild West. And, who's the sheriff? Who's going to come into town? Or is it just completely uncool to involve ourselves in these things?
Yes, I have two questions. First, how do you explain that people, especially young people, can spend hours listening to a singer and very carefully and listening to the words and pay a lot of money for that and do just the opposite with the web?
Well, actually, that's not quite true, because of course you can do the logs of people who download. Now, if you remember, I mean, I don't know, I still buy CDs, and I used to buy LPs, and used to buy the whole thing, and you used to read the whole thing, or listen to the whole thing, and then you'd have your... Because it wasn't so easy to move around, you tended to listen to the whole thing. And because you now download tapes and records, and they've noticed that the average time a young person spends is about 10 or 15 seconds before they move off to another one. So they're doing exactly the same thing, they're just sampling, you know, through the catalogue in the same kind of way.
Not in concerts, though.
No, not in concerts. No, I mean, no. But Maybe we need to think about concerts, but...
My second question is that maybe you know that some time ago it was revealed that Sigmund Freud had an affair with his, I think, sister-in-law, and this has been proved how? By a small piece of paper, bill, hotel bill, from some kind of mountain resort. And you may know or not know that Max Frisch, who is the most respected writer, Swiss writer of the 20th century, in fact, was a xenophobe, and that is, he signed texts against foreign writers to write during the war in Switzerland. But it's also very little known because there are few texts proving that. And I am a great supporter of cyber media, but when the cyber media did not exist, I was dreaming of cyber media which would facilitate this kind of connection, being able to connect Freud with his hotel bill or Max Frisch. In the case of Max Frisch, he in fact is one who, prevented Robert Musil to write, and Robert Musil, I think, died in Switzerland during the war, and you can learn a lot of things about Musil's poverty through his mail with the electricity board. So normally what the cyber media should be used for, and what search engine would be useful for, is to facilitate that. Whereas, in fact, it is much more likely now with the electronic media that the last proof of what happened with Max Frisch will be dropped in the paper bin, because most intellectuals consider absolutely uninteresting to prove that Max Frisch was not as clean as it seemed. So there is something missing in the search engines. The search engines are reactionary and are clannish in a way. So cyberspace is fantastic, but search engines are medieval.
Yes, I'm sure they are. But which just what you just said just sort of raised something else in my mind, is that it's difficult to know what truth and fact is anymore in that virtual space, because you don't know who's peddling the kind of information. And because so many people seek out, so especially young people, seek out information from the crowd, from their Facebook friends. And, you know, we've done quite a few studies at UCL on these crowds. Is that you ask a friend, yes? Well, you know, is there really global warming? You know, well, let's ask a friend. And that friend says, rubbish, there's no global warming. And everybody else in the group. Now, we've had invisible colleges, we still have invisible colleges, and they're quite powerful, but the important thing about invisible college is that there should be somebody somewhere who knows something about it to pass the information on. But there is a very, very big danger now in the fragmented and disintegrated world we are in, where anything goes, the wisdom of the crowd is okay, that anything is correct, anything could be the truth. And I think we're beginning to see this now, is that, you know, this whole concept of truth, authority, is being challenged, massively challenged. Even here on radio programs, TV, and everybody knows. And the opinions that you get on the web and you pick up on the blogs are in the same formula as anything else. They all look the same. They're on the web, so that must be okay. It's on the TV, so it must be correct. And there's a blurring of the landscape. You can just see this, which is storing up kind of things. Yeah, Wikipedia, interesting, isn't it? Most popular source.
So promise us you will come again here to deliver a lecture on this topic soon.
Yeah. Okay, I don't mind. But I mean, the trouble is, when you talk about this, you can sound like an old man, uncool, you know, this is, but it's not. I just see this, the wonderful opportunities. I just see great things, and I just think there needs to be somebody doing something seriously about what's going on, raising the question, doing something about it, maximizing the resource, all of those things, and not just treating it like wallpaper, which I'm afraid we are treating information as wallpaper, because it is so around, it's not special, and why bother, it's all the same thing, you know. Whereas that controlled intermediated environment, which had been measured and controlled and reviewed. You had no such problems because you knew when you were in that world you were safe. Or were you? Some people would challenge that. But you can see the differences that we're in, you know, complete and utter difference. In my lifetime, yeah, less than my lifetime, there has been a huge and massive shift. And that has brought massive change. Good, bad, indifferent, we don't know yet. And just think of Victoria and her flicking. I couldn't have flicked. I never flicked. We had four channels. I didn't have a remote, so if I had to change, I had to walk, press the button, and that all put me off doing that. She has 800, of which she can't remember most. And it's a bit like that in the world of the web. So I'd really like to know whether physics are really hanging on to physics abstracts and all of those other kinds of things, or whether they become like the medics in North London. You'll have to do a study.
Any other questions? Oh, sorry, yes.